Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from the English countryside here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybar.
I'm Philisco.
And with us again, the woman who will talk about anything except the war zone.
She'll talk Jessica about
Ellis.
It.
Jessica Ellis, thank you for allowing us to punk you with yet another movie.
I'm so glad to be here for a fun family adventure film, you know, really a lighthearted.
It is a family adventure. I would agree with that.
I just want to be very clear about something. I did not know what this movie was about, Jessica, when I asked you if you would come on for this podcast. I don't know if, Kenny, you knew what this movie was about. I knew it was grim. Like, I knew that it was a tough watch. That was kind of all I knew. I didn't even really know about the cast until I sent you the link, Jessica. And I was like, huh, I mean, Tilda Swinton and Ray Winstone and Colin Farrell briefly. Like, sure. How bad can this movie be? But I just genuinely didn't know what I was subjecting you to. So I want to apologize in advance.
I want to apologize for bailing three quarters of the way through the movie.
No.
Oh, you didn't finish the movie.
We'll get into why.
I understand. Hey, I understand. I too, all right. So
you broke it into two, right? Like you watched.
I broke it into like six. I mean, it's not a fun movie to watch.
No.
I will say, I know when you stopped, Jessica, I also stopped at that exact place. And coincidentally, I mean, it's not much of a coincidence. It's where one stops. And I came back this morning, and I'm not trying to say like the end redeems it, because it is not really exactly redeemable. But there's some shit Ray Winstone does in that last 30 minutes that I think is pretty fucking remarkable acting and writing. So I'm not trying to say it's like great or whatever, or it's a fantastic movie, but there is a specificity of this particular type of abuser who has complete and total power over the people he abuses, that he wields in a way that is not cartoonish in the end. You know, I think we're used to so many kind of cartoon depictions. Look, I really enjoy the movie It, for instance, but the depiction of the one female member of the Loser Gang's character, the father, that's what you get all the time. You get an abusive father character generally towards a daughter, sexually abusive. You don't see anything, not that you necessarily should, I'm just saying, you don't see anything that she really experiences firsthand, and then that person is, you know, dealt with in a poetically just way. What Ray Winston does in the end of this movie is pretty, you know, clever, remarkable, nuanced, and true. I mean, it's really upsetting. So I left last night thinking that this movie was total dog shit, and I finished this morning and think there are redeeming qualities to the movie. It is a full thought, is kind of what I'm getting at.
I totally agree with you. I don't think the movie is poorly made, and I think the best thing about it is how they portray the dad. Like, I think that's actually very brilliant. My problems were not actually with the subject, but the depiction.
I'm sure, yeah.
That's like where I felt like, yeah, Roth crossed a huge line with that.
Yeah, not to cut you off. Sorry, just real quick, because of something Phil said earlier, like, I knew that there was incest in this movie. That wouldn't have stopped me. Stopped me from sending it to anybody. We've seen movies with incest. What am I going to do? Not show you Chinatown? Like, there are movies where that's central to the plot, and you just kind of roll with it. Yeah, to Jessica's point, oh man, I didn't know what I was getting into in terms of, like, you know, what we were going to be shown and the circumstances under which we were going to be shown it.
Yeah, I mean, it's... So I would like to give the synopsis real early on this one, because I feel like it's worth, you know, $250,000 is how much this movie made. And I imagine that's the amount of people that saw this film. So for us to unpack this movie properly, I just want to give the synopsis so that we can sort of come at this and people aren't like, what is this movie about and what's going on? After his family relocates from London to rural Devon, sullen British teen Tom spends most of his time moping around the house when he inadvertently discovers an incestuous relationship between his older sister, Jessie, played by Lara Belmont, and their father, played by Ray Winstone. The revelation threatens to have dire consequences. The mother of the family, played by Tilda Swinton, unaware of the dark secret, has recently given birth, and the siblings must contend with the harrowing situation. The war zone opened on December 10th, 1999, against The Green Mile, Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo, Toy Story 2, The World Is Not Enough, and End of Days. It would go on to, as I mentioned, make about $250,000. It's got 84% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 83% from audiences. I'm going to read a chunk here of Roger Ebert's
Before you go on, let's play More or Less Problematic. More or less problematic than Deuce Bigelow?
Have you seen Deuce Bigelow, Jessica?
Yeah, I would make an interesting double feature.
Which goes first?
I would say I don't know. That's a hard one to answer. It's less problematic because Deuce Bigelow is stupid. Like, it's not saying anything seriously damaging.
Deuce Bigelow has a heart.
Deuce Bigelow is not damaging anyone's life, and I would argue that this movie has the potential to.
More or less problematic than The Green Mile.
It's funny you bring that up, Kenny, because I was having a discussion with a friend about The Green Mile the other day, who had rewatched it recently and actually quite liked it. It makes me wonder whether or not, I mean, we did The Green Mile in year one of this podcast, I believe, so it's been a beat. I'm still sure that I wouldn't like that film, but the tropes that movie plays in are problematic. And I think that this movie doesn't have tropes necessarily.
It doesn't have Mouseville either.
It does not have most of
them. Nothing redeeming them. Yeah, no,
I really knew very little about it. I knew Tim Roth directed it. It's his directorial debut. He has not directed a film since. I knew that Ebert liked it. I didn't know how much he liked it. You mentioned it was on his top 10 list. I completely forgot it was.
Which is the main reason that I even, you know, thought we should do it, had to do it. Any movie that's making Ebert's top 10 list in this particular year is a object of fascination for
me.
Right. And you know, Ebert always, when he did his top 10 list, particularly in the Sun Times, he'd also do like often a second 10 and then a whole bunch of honorable mentions. Mm-hmm. So all the movies at this beat to get on his top 10, I thought this was worth watching, and we don't have the choice. Frankly, we have to watch it. That's our job. Yeah,
we're always going to do it.
That's our job here. But you know, I do think that a British movie that made $250,000, even directed by a movie star, could have slipped under the radar if it weren't for Ebert putting it on his top 10 under our radar. I mean,
yes. Yeah. For sure. It's so going into that, I started watching the film. Generally speaking, I don't read Ebert's reviews of movies I haven't seen, because I don't want him to sway me one way or the other. So I read the review after watching the film. Let me read this portion. It must have been something like this in medieval times. Families living in isolation, cut off from neighbors, forced indoors by the weather, their animal and sexual functions not always shielded from view. Tim Roth's The War Zone, brilliantly and heartbreaking, takes place in the present, but it's timeless, most particularly in its cut off from the fix-it culture of psychobabble, which defies all the politically correct ways to consider incest. The movie is not about incest as an issue, but about incest as a blow to the heart and the soul of a real event here and now in a family that seems close and happy, not a topic on a talk show. But this isn't the case of Tom discovering incest in his family and blowing the whistle. It's much more complicated. How does he feel about his sister and about her relationship with her new boyfriend, Nick? What about his father's eerie split personality, able to deny his behavior and see Tom's interference as an assault on their happy family? What about the mother's willingness not to know? What about his sister's denial? Does it spring from shame, fear, or desire to shield Tom and her mother from the knowledge? Unsurprisingly, The War Zone affects viewers much more powerfully than a simple morality tale might. It's not simply about the evils of incest, but about its dynamic, about the way it does play upon guilt and shame and address old and secret wounds. The critic James Baradinelli, forgive me, I butchered his name, says that when he saw the film at the Toronto Film Festival, a viewer ran from the theater saying he couldn't take it anymore and went looking to pull a fire alarm. Roth was standing near the exit and intercepted him, becoming confessor for an emotional outpouring that the movie had inspired. Roth is one of the best actors now working, and with this movie, he reveals himself as a director of surprising gifts. Roth and his actors and Stewart's screenplay understand these people and their situation down to the final nuance and are willing to let silence, timing, and visuals reveal what dialogue would cheapen. Not many movies bring you to a dead halt of sorrow and empathy. This one does. I mean, I appreciate what he's saying, and I appreciate the way that he feels about the way that incest is depicted in this film. I would agree that it's specifically, as you mentioned, Kenny, the father's portrayal that makes this not, quote unquote, just another movie about incest. At the same time, it's so harrowing to watch. And on top of all of this, Laura Belmont and Freddie Cunliffe, the two actors, were both underage during filming. Their parents read the script and were aware of what was involved. The last thing any of us wants in the production is to scar the kids in any way, said Tim Roth. I'm sure that's true, but this is just very upsetting to watch, and I'm not entirely convinced a necessary movie, I guess. I mean, I don't know how else to say it other than the fact that I'm not sure that we needed this film. I'm not saying that it shouldn't exist. I'm saying that I don't know what it's bringing to the table that's entirely worthwhile to me personally. That's where I come out on it. Kenny, do you have thoughts on this?
I didn't know they were underage. That's really upsetting. Just to hear that, that's really upsetting. I don't expect anyone to rush out to watch this movie. I wouldn't suggest anybody does it. So, you know, and by the way, like, massive trigger warnings from here on out, I would say. Because I think that it's, you know, you have to discuss some really disgusting things and really disturbing things in order to actually get at the movie. The spine of this film. So this movie is has a lot of nudity. And a lot of nudity from all the characters, Tilda Swinton and Ray Winston, full frontal for both of them. And Laura Belmont is nude. Is that
Belmont,
right?
You're right.
Belmont. Is nude for in four or five scenes. Yeah. And she is just raped in one scene. Like it's one of the most insane things I'd ever seen on film. This underage character, played by now an underage actor, raped by her father in a very matter of fact way. And it's I'm not trying to disagree with you, Phil, because I hesitate to say anything like is not a movie that, you know, we need or whatever, like a movie that makes you feel.
I'm not saying I'm not for censorship, just to be clear. Like, I'm not saying.
Of course you're not.
This movie. I'm just saying I don't know what this movie is.
Look, there are movies that I have never seen. I never will see. Like, I'm never going to see Irreversible. I have no interest in seeing that movie based on what I've heard about it. I'm never going to see a Serbian film. You know, there are movies that I'm just not going to see. Right. This is kind of on the border of that. And what do you do with a movie like that? Like, my argument for this film would be, it's not really it actually is the content for me. I don't know how else to put it. I don't like saying that, but it actually is the content that makes it so repulsive and makes it something that I just don't want to ride for. I don't know how else to put it. Jessica,
yeah.
You feel?
Yeah, Jessica, please.
Yeah, I mean, the context I had coming to this movie was knowing that Roth is an incest survivor, and so was his father.
Oh, God.
They were both.
I did not know that.
Yeah, they were both raped by his paternal grandfather. He talked about it a little when this movie came out, and then he talked about it more in an interview about 4 years ago, and I read all of that before I saw the movie. So approaching this movie, having directed exactly as many movies as Tim Roth has, I really was looking at it as like, this is a pretty young guy working through this trauma. Yeah. And, you know, all power to victims of this kind of thing to work through their trauma how they need to. But the minute he decided to shift the victim's point of view to a young girl and to do this to an underage, completely unexperienced actress, that felt exploitative to me. That felt like someone trying to reenact what had happened to them in a way they could control, but not thinking about what that puts on the actress, not thinking about that from a female perspective of how it is different. And the moment I checked out on this was the rape scene, because the girl is full frontal. I mean, it's like a real time scene. And the guy, the father's genitals are carefully hidden behind his shirt. And I was like, no, that's it. We are caring more about this actor's modesty and this and protecting that and some standard of what we can show with women versus what we can show as men. It felt incorrect to me to be watching that film. I can't imagine being, you know, I was an actress when I was 17. I can imagine saying yes to a role like this because of the opportunities it afforded. And you know, you want to do dramatic stuff, but I hope that actress is okay, because that is an enormous amount to put on a child's, you know, mind at that age, and having her body just out there in public in screenings for Roger Ebert to watch and have deep thoughts about is, I don't know. I found that over the line for me, while having sympathy for a lot of the portrayals and for Roth grappling with this story. Like, it just felt like, I don't know if this is somebody that's processed their trauma enough that they can talk about this stuff in a way that doesn't harm the people they're making reenact it.
I mean, obviously an incredibly valid perspective on this. I also thought the same thing during the bunker scene that we're talking about, the fact that she is so exposed and he is not. It was hard not to notice that to some degree or another. It's also just, I mean, and I, to talk about this movie, you have to talk about these things, but the sort of the sodomy component of the sequence was also sort of an additional awful thing where, you know, she's asking why he won't have sex with her like he does with her mother, which is adding sort of, there's these layers of just emotional and physical abuse in that one sequence, that makes it hard for the film, at least for me. I mean, I watched it, I guess, kind of in like two chunks, but hard for the film to come back from that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying what you were saying, Kenny, is incorrect. I agree with you that the movie comes as close to coming back from this with the portrayal of the father, but I still would say that it doesn't, for me personally, make it all the way back. It's just you're watching something so harrowing and so awful that I don't know, like my brain's like on some has switched off to some degree or another from that point on.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like Jessica said it as well as anyone can say it. It's, you know, what the, it's almost too generous to call it a technique, but the technique employed by Roth in that bunker scene is, I think, maybe unforgivable. And, you know, it's like, who can watch Last Tango in Paris now, knowing what you know about the way that movie was made? Yeah. You know, and there is a, in particular, a movie like that, right? You know, it's a little different. I mean, like, I can watch I Heart Huckabees knowing that David O. Russell was mean, but knowing what happened on the set of Last Tango in Paris and so many movies from, I mean, Karina Longworth did the whole erotic 80s podcast on this, and so many of the stories of these erotic thrillers of the 80s were, you know, like 8 and a half and things like that, where these female actresses just being abused and being forced into situations where they had no control and where they weren't, you know, empowered to say stop, or they did say stop and they weren't listened to. And I think it's even compounded by in this film, because this is 1999. We're supposed to know better. And this is a 17-year-old or a 16-year-old. It's hard to know. I looked at her. She was born in 80. This movie was probably made in 97, something like that, 96 maybe. Mm-hmm. It's just, yeah, it's the only thing I would say is I'm thinking, like, at least it wasn't done in a way that was like Last Tango in Paris, where I believe Last Tango in Paris kind of felt like they were romanticizing the relationship a little bit. Right. And that's not what was happening here.
Sure.
But I think your point about, you know, kind of the power imbalance that comes from the actors, you know, because Ray Winston is full frontal earlier in a non-sexual scene. But the power imbalance that comes from the actors having the ability to say, you know, one having no power and having to do whatever the director says, the guy from Pulp Fiction says, and the other actor saying, you know, you shoot my dick and I'll kick your ass. I think that's a pretty big deal. And I think that's almost disqualifying. I think at that point you kind of can't even make the film.
I don't disagree. I you know, it's interesting because I guess when they were shooting the bunker scene, one of the sound grips ruined a take by crying. Ray Winstone found the scene so upsetting that he nearly left the production on several occasions. I guess you got to ask yourself, what are you doing at a certain point?
Yeah,
you
know? I mean, and we're in that era of, you know, in the late 90s of like the all-powerful auteur director. And you just, I'm sorry, you don't have the right to make people suffer like that to get a movie. You just don't, as you wouldn't in any other scenario. Like, that still makes you an awful person. I'm sorry, Tim Roth.
No, 100%. I mean, I think that, you know, it makes me think of you know, Lars von Trier comes to mind.
Yeah.
You know, a filmmaker who believes that he can put his actors through whatever is necessary to get the performance. This is not defending his actions, but he has got some pretty incredible performances out of people. That's not to say that it was worth what they went through. I mean, Bjork has made it clear that she'll never act again, despite her brief cameo in The Northman. But like, I just think it's interesting that we're still kind of letting this happen. You know what I mean? Like it's yeah, sorry.
So it's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, the public did not have access to this information, right? For a bunch of reasons. There were the media wasn't reporting on it. There weren't entertainment reporters the way there was. Also, women didn't feel like they could say something. Women and men, right? And directors wielded so much power with the studios, and producers were protecting directors and all that stuff. What that meant was, and I'm just being as, you know, 30,000 feet as I can, you know, as completely emotionally, you know, distant, emotionally removed from this, is what that meant was the finished product was the finished product and the audience just got the finished product. So a director can sit back and be like, it doesn't matter what I do. The art is the art, right? You can't do that anymore as an artist, because art is not just art anymore. All right. And I know that sounds stupid, but I know everything that went into now because I'm a online person, and because I'm a person who's aware of what's going on in the media, I know everything about Don't Worry, Darling. I know everything about that movie. Right. And I can't possibly go into Don't Worry, Darling and pretend I don't. It's part of the movie now. Right. Just like I go watch a Woody Allen movie and that's part of the movie. Just like I go watch, you know, look, there's a
Amsterdam.
Rolling Stone just did their top 100 television shows. And notably to me, I mean, notably to Sepinwall, who put it together, but notably to me, Louis and The Cosby Show were left off. I get why Louis and The Cosby Show were left off. You can't watch those shows without thinking about what these guys did, right? And I think there actually is a line. Like, I think there actually is a line where you can turn your brain off and you can't turn your brain off, right? So I know, or turn your brain, or like turn the volume down a little bit, right? Shows made by or starring other awful people were on there. Chappelle's Show was on there, you know? So there is a thing where there is a little bit of a line, but no, you can't just assume that the audience is not going to be aware of how this movie is made. Audiences are savvy. Audiences are online. Audiences have access to all this information, and it all matters. And by the way, like, you can't have it both fucking ways. You can't be like, you can't be, as much as we love Eyes Wide Shut, you can't be Stanley Kubrick and say, well, I want you to bring your understanding of Tom Cruise's star personality and about his marriage with Nicole Kidman, bring that to the movie. That's good. But don't bring any stories you heard about what I put them through on the set. Like, don't bring that stuff. That's not fair. But please, like, understand that, like, Tom Cruise has this interesting relationship with his sexuality. Please understand that Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman have this relationship that may or may not be set up by Scientology. Please bring all that stuff with you. Like, it's just not the truth. There's no value judgment here. It's just not the truth. So, yeah, I do think that this is almost like to the point of being disqualifying. I think you're living in some kind of fantasy world if you think that this is not the case.
I absolutely agree. I think that, you know, it's interesting because I do feel like there are filmmakers. Take a David Fincher, for instance, right? A guy who notoriously will make you do 100 takes of a thing because he wants to see you stop acting, essentially, right? I've never read anything about Fincher being abusive. I mean, people say he's a hard ass.
He's a taskmaster.
I mean? He's a taskmaster, and he knows what he wants, and he wants to get you there. And I think that's somewhat similar to Kubrick to a degree. I'm not trying to conflate the Eyes Wide Shut thing, but I just think that it's just interesting how some filmmakers just that line just gets lost, right? Where professionalism goes out the window and an artistic ideal is worth essentially abusing people for. And I mean, to me, that's just obviously insane. And I don't understand why we allow it. I like to think that we're allowing it less and less because all of this stuff is coming out and that's a good thing. But watching this at this time with all of the stuff that Tim Roth was bringing to this emotional baggage, I didn't know about watching it. This was clearly an attempt to work through his issues, but he lost the thread, right? Like he conflated all of these other things that I think muddied the waters. So it's all kind of the thesis statement or whatever sort of catharsis he was looking for. I mean, I hope he found it. I don't know. I don't know what to even say.
Jessica, you're a actual real life filmmaker.
I'm trying to be.
when you're thinking about what to write in, but things you're going to be directing in particular, mm-hmm. right? Things that you're actually going to be kind of, you know, a Jessica Ellis film about. How do you approach the difficult stuff that you know your actors are, you know, there, you know, there's a bad way to do it, you know, and you know, there's a less bad way to do it. How do you approach these tricky situations?
It's tough. I mean, I particularly have a reverence for the responsibility that a director bears to not ruin anybody's life. Like that was why I avoided directing for so long, was because so many of my early experiences, like watching directors and being in plays and stuff, were with really dictatorial, brutal, auteur style directors. And I was like, well, I don't want to be that. And that's all I'm seeing. So when I am writing stuff that's going to be emotionally difficult, that's going to be, you know, sexual at all, you know, my first question is like, would I agree to do this on screen? And, you know, like if somebody said, like, we need to shoot this scene with you doing this, would you do it? And so that's question one. Question two is like, it's stuff that I try to, it's something I will always talk with actors about. It's like, let's get into this. Where are you uncomfortable? Is there a way we can do this? We'll make you feel better. You know, I haven't gotten, unfortunately, to direct with an intimacy coordinator, but I really think that's a great idea that we've incorporated into that, because it is also very difficult for actors who are trying to make a good impression on their director and stay on their good side to be fully honest and say, you know, I'm uncomfortable with this, whatever. And giving yourself a little space in a third party that can be a, you know, a translator for both sides is helpful. But I mean, there are ways to be authentic without being brutal. There have to be. If I can't find one, I'm not a good enough writer to handle that material, and I shouldn't approach it, because the risk of actually damaging someone is too great. And as much as I love movies and have made my whole life and career about them, I don't believe a movie is worth anybody's like real psychological suffering. I don't think that's why we do this. I don't think that's good for anybody.
We've managed to find ways to kill people on screen without killing them in real life.
Yeah.
I think we can do this.
You know? But there is, you know, this cult of idea that pain must be real on screen. And it's just like, I don't know. Sure, I don't think so.
This is, yeah.
Isn't the Laurence Olivier thing? Try acting.
I'm very much on the try acting side of it.
I am 100% on the filmmaking is, you know, S&M, right? Like filmmaking requires consent from all sides, requires consistent consent, require you should have a safe word. Like if someone wants to go, now look, there sometimes people are dangerous to themselves, but if someone wants to go, you know, hardcore method and stay up for 2 days to look tired for a scene, I'm tempted to say go for it. Now, look, that comes with a bunch of caveats. That comes with, I really know this actor really knows me. We really trust each other. We are in this together from the beginning to the end. The same way you should be if you were in a sexual relationship that involves bondage. It's the same idea, right? Like literally, it's the same idea that you are edge playing so close together that you have to be 100% in line. And to bring it back to Warzone. Just like with sexual consent, literally impossible with a 16-year-old. Well, literally impossible.
I couldn't agree with you more. And you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about another film that the three of us have talked about, which was Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which we talked about on our 89 Patreon, which was which we all loved and is a great movie. And I would argue proves that you don't need to be sexually explicit to be sexually explicit, right? Like the emotional terrain that film traverses, I think is, I guess what I'm getting at is I think that this film could very well have spoken to all of the issues that it's speaking to without being as graphic as it was. Now, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, would we be talking about this film if the whole movie had been like Tom accidentally seeing the father and daughter in a bathtub together, which we don't actually see? You know, could this have been an off-screen type situation or one that's less graphic and been as effective? I don't know, but it makes me wonder.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with sexual explicitness in movies. In fact, I think it's a good idea because we're all so uncomfortable with nudity in general. But, you know, when you back up a few feet and look at the power structure of Hollywood, it's like, I don't believe Kate Blanchett is ever going to do a nude scene she doesn't want to do now, because she's an incredibly powerful actress and she has the capability to say no without damaging her career.
Yeah.
But a 20-year-old girl, a 17-year-old girl, especially an untrained actor, which this was, like, you know, because a lot of actors are, like you said, Kenny, they're willing to do crazy things. They like pushing the envelope. They like pushing their limits, and that's fine. And you have to, like, you know, be a good shield around them while they're trying to do that. But I wasn't
trying to be puritanical.
Yeah.
I was just saying that the power of this medium, which is very powerful, doesn't necessarily have to be graphic as well, is I guess what I'm getting at.
No, but I also don't. Yeah, but it also doesn't have to be hidden. It just has to depend on the cape, like the your actors and how they feel, and if they have the institutional power to for you to know that they're being honest with you about whether they're okay about it.
Look, I think, Jessica, you're saying that. It just reminds me of a film that I can't even believe that we did, and we didn't, and we let Jordan get away with what she got away with talking about it. But this reminds me, The General's Daughter, which is a horrible movie. And
let Jordan get away with what she did.
I hope she gets tagged on the episode, because, like, I just can't believe we let Jordan try to not even convince us, because she never convinced me. But
she railroaded that episode.
Her. part of her argument for showing, you know, essentially, if you don't know Jessica, I'm sure you know The General's Daughter, you know, at least by reputation.
Yeah.
But the John Travolta film where a young woman is raped and killed on a military base, and
splayed out and like strapped to the ground,
and you see a little, but what you really see is this like really beautiful woman in this incredibly vulnerable situation, and it never felt to me like it was anything other than, you know, the basest level of exploitation.
Yeah.
But Jordan's point, which I don't think applies to that movie, was she can't avoid it. Why should we? Right. The scene, the depicting the rape. Right. If she has to experience it, perhaps we should too, which I think is a fairly powerful argument. I think it's a quite powerful argument for a lot of movies, not for a shitty ass movie like General's Daughter, which isn't actually about that. But
like a giant studio movie. Like it's a crazy that movie's insane. That movie
is just it's not ultimately in any way it's a MacGuffin crime. Right. It's a MacGuffin crime. It's just about like this horrible thing happened. Let's solve the crime. Yep. This is not about that. This is actually about the act and the way it kind of the effect it has on all these people. So I do think to some extent that depiction here is warranted. Mm-hmm. I think the way they did it is disastrous. And I think that's really all it comes down to. And particularly because it was, you know, you were viewing it from Tom's point of view, because he was videotaping it, because clearly, you know, what's ironic about the whole thing is this movie, this deeply understands power dynamics. The whole reason Tom is videotaping this act is not because he wants to, it's because he knows he's going to need the proof, because he's a 16-year-old little idiot and his parents are not going, or his dad's not going to back down, and his mom's not going to believe him unless he could show him the proof, or at least, you know, I think he has reason to believe that.
Yeah.
Right. So we're seeing it from Tom's point of view. But you see it again in this way where Ray Winstone's completely covered up. and Lauren, I forgot her name again.
Laura Belmont.
Laura Belmont is not. And it's pretty gross.
What I think is also interesting and worth unpacking for a second here is sort of the first 40 minutes of this movie, let's say half hour, 40 minutes of this film, where I genuinely didn't know where it was going. I thought that the performances were all interesting. I thought that Tilda Swinton, who is always great, who had literally just given birth to twins prior to the making of this film. I appreciated the fact that that she was willing and wrapped her arms around the idea of the physicality of what pregnancy, you know, does to your body. She looked like a person who just had children. It was, that shouldn't be brave or whatever the word is that people would associate with it. I just appreciated that she did it. I think that she's always a great actor. I don't know that she's given a whole lot to do in this film, which was a little bit disappointing. But the first portion of the film, I found, you know, kind of interesting in a sort of Ken Loach, Mike Lee kind of way of just feeling like, you know, fly on the wall of a family in England and her delivering the kid after the car gets.
Oh, yeah,
car.
That was wild.
That shit was wild. I was like, what? Like, this is crazy.
Yeah, that was wild. Like, he totally forgot about that. Yeah.
Seem to have blood on them for like 5 days after that car accident. I didn't know if that was just we didn't have makeup to do realistic wounds or if that was supposed to be like foreshadowing.
Yeah. But it was like it started in a place that I was like, you know, okay, I'm alarmed for this ride. I didn't, as I mentioned, Kenny, I didn't know about the incest. I didn't know about where it was going. I thought it was effectively directed. And then it just careens off into a place where it just can never rebound for me. But I will say that, you know, Ray Winstone, who is very good in this movie, who's a very good actor. I mean, I don't know that I've ever disliked Ray Winstone in anything, quite frankly. He always feels very believable.
But I've never seen him. I've never seen him capital A act like this before.
Scene when he is gaslighting both of them.
Yeah, just at the end of the movie. I mean, just so you have, we'll blow it for people. Yeah. But basically, Tom confronts him.
Yeah. There's two scenes, right?
The first thing that happens, before he even confronts him, actually, the first thing that happens, he goes and tells Tilda Swinton about it. Tilda Swinton calls Ray Winstone and says, don't come to see the baby. The baby's in the hospital. And I'm not going to describe what happens to the baby.
I read the Wikipedia summary.
It's insanity. Yeah. Oh, so you know what happened. All right. So basically.
Wait, did I miss something with the baby?
Yeah.
Did you watch a hype, like an edited version?
No, but you're going to have to tell me what it was. Cause I genuinely don't remember.
The baby is bleeding internally and you see a lot of blood come out. You didn't see that?
You
literally may have had like an episode where you blocked it out.
It's possible, or quite frankly, I was looking at my phone for a moment and missed it. So
good moment to look at your phone.
Apparently.
So Tom tells went off camera, yes. But she calls Ray Winstone and says, don't come see the baby. But Ray Winstone at that point doesn't know why she said that, correct, you know? Correct. So Tom comes home and,
Jesse?
Jesse is crying, says, thanks, Tom. But again, you know, she doesn't, we don't know exactly what's up. And then Tom.
That moment, by the way, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. That moment when she's crying and literally I just want to say she's great in this movie.
She's incredible.
She's incredible in this film. Her body is convulsing and she's like,
there's a tenderness between those two between the brother and sister characters that, well,
Jessica has thoughts about Tom, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, we can talk about that in a second. But all right, hold on. So more or less what happens is Tom tells Ray Winstone, you fucked her, you fucked my sister. Yeah. And Ray Winstone immediately is like, you're out of your mind. Like, you're out of your mind. Like, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm going to put
He's
you
like
away.
Screaming at him because, like, Tom runs to his bedroom. and just sort of because the, no, well, something first, about the geography first, of it, I think, is
absurd. First, Ray Winston starts hitting him. He doesn't just like run away. First, he starts hitting him. Yeah. Tom kind of runs away to safety, and Ray Winston keeps yelling up the stairs, "I'm going to send you away. I'm going to basically send you to a sanitarium." Yep. He goes up to his room. Jesse follows, and they lock themselves in the room.
Yeah.
And then they go like in that room. I think is when Jesse is like also says it, right? And then Ray Winston immediately is like, "Look what you did! You made her start believing it. You're now she's believing your lies, right?" Yeah. Tom grabs a knife at some point, and. Yeah. It happened before this, actually, but Tom grabs a knife, and in the course of an argument where he's, you know, where he continues to gaslight, Tom stabs him, and he kind of, you know, bleeds out on the floor, like calling for Jesse. There is also a moment where you do think, like, at least I thought that they, that Jesse and Tom were going to, you know, have some kind of romantic moment,
which they do in the book.
That doesn't surprise me at all, by the way. And because I thought it was going to happen, and I'm like, oh yeah, I saw this coming, but it didn't happen. They just kind of spoon on a bed, and fucking good for them for not doing it. Honestly, I see thematically why you would do it, but you also just destroy this character, and you it's. It implies something about humanity that I wouldn't want to imply if I were making this film, you know?
Yeah. I mean, when I read that it happened in the book, I was like, yeah, no, I think the movie does a better job of implying it and then actually going there. I mean, I'd say it's one of the ways that this film holds back a little bit. There's clearly a inappropriate connection between these two characters, and I'm thankful that they don't consummate it as they do in the book.
I think the whole point to me is that while there may be an attraction from Tom to Jesse, mm-hmm. there probably is. Mm-hmm. I believe the point is that his morality is overriding it, and I think that that's fairly important. You know, I think, like, it's funny, you just watch Little Children, right? And I think so much of what Little Children is about is like, is it broken? Are you broken if you're like this? Or is there any way to override this thing that Jack Earl Haley's character, you know, has? Like, is that overridable or are they born monsters? And I feel like if Tom slept with Jesse or they had some kind of thing, sexual thing, it's not so much that he was a born monster, but that he would have been, you know, kind of broken and unable to deprogram himself, unable to, like, you know, untangle those wires. And that would have, to me, honestly, that would have just, that this movie's fucking bleak as shit, but that would have been like bleak forever. That would have just been like bleak, like forever, forever, like generational trauma. You will never come out from underneath it. Like, we will always be like held down by it. At least this is somewhat hopeful in the idea of, like, no, you actually can kind of reprogram yourself. You know, the sins of your father are not necessarily, you're not necessarily fated to follow them. So I don't know. I think this is, you know, an extremely kind of interesting film, and obviously I'm compelled by it. Like, I think it's an interesting conversation to have out of it. But I also,
what are your thoughts on Tom, Jessica?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't finish the movie. I read the summary. So I'm not, like, I know what happens, but I don't necessarily know all the context in which it happens. I was incredibly disturbed by the scene where Tom first confronts Jesse. They're outside the house. It's early on, and he's seen them in the bath, and he brings it up, and she's like, no, nothing happens. And he attacks her. I mean, he physically throws her to the ground, gets on top of her, is choking her. And it's not like siblings wrestling. We've seen them, like, play wrestle before. It's violent and aggressive and possessive. And that, to me, was what the movie became about at that point, was that these are actually just two men warring over owning the women in an isolated location where there's no other society and there's no other options. Like, so I don't know, like, Tom is a character I didn't particularly like that actor's performance. I thought it was very blank and very just not, I didn't get a lot out of it. But mm-hmm. it felt so brutally possessive of her, and the way like he as like a 15, 16 year old boy is comfortable walking in on his sister when she's topless. Like, I don't know if either of you guys had siblings, but if my brother did that to me, I would have like screamed bloody murder and killed him. Like, and they do it entirely casually. Like a lot of the nudity stuff in the movie, I'm kind of interested by, like Tilda Swinton breastfeeding and like, you know, the way it's in discussion about like family intimacy and what is okay and what isn't okay and nudity and context. But like, you don't
the parents being nude on the bed together.
Yeah.
Just all that. Yeah, yeah.
But you don't sit down on a bed with your, as a teenager with your naked sister. That's not, I don't think that's a common dynamic. And so I don't know. I mean, it was obvious that she was somewhat the focus of his like sexual fantasizing, partially because he had no other options out there in the middle of nowhere. And they were so clearly isolated, but like, I don't know. I didn't feel like he was a loving brother. I felt like he was fighting for possession of her because he was angry that she had been raped. He was angry at her the same way the father is angry at her for having a boyfriend.
I think the fact that it is unusual is the point. You know,
the
relationship they had, I think that's the point of the relationship. I think the point is that he's confused. I think, you know, there's, it's no coincidence that the girl he's quote unquote supposed to be into, this girl, Lucy, looks a lot like his sister.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's definitely what Tim Roth is teeing up there. And I think the isolation is a big part of it. My read on the character and the performance is just a little, I mean, softer than yours, which is he is 15 or 16. He is, he has been kicked out of two schools. He has been uprooted. This is an incredibly heavy thing for him to be, you know, grappling with. And I don't know if there is a quote unquote right way to deal with what he's learning in this situation. I also think that, yeah, he might have been mad at Jesse. She was lying to him. Now, I'm not saying she shouldn't have been. I'm not saying that he should have been mad at her, but I do think the reaction when I saw something inappropriate between you and Dad, and she's stone-faced telling him, I would tell you if there was something inappropriate and there's not. That's when he started to feel like there's something going on here that is feeling wrong and feeling off to me. So I don't feel like, I just don't feel like it's,
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I don't feel like what's happening in the movie is two men warring for this possession of this woman. I think it's a man possesses this woman and a boy is trying to figure out exactly how he feels about the situation that has been foisted upon him.
Well, and also I think it's, I mean, yeah, there's a part of me too that feels like it is about Tom figuring out his sexual feelings as well, to some degree, whether they're about his sister or about just women in general. I think he's obviously a very confused young man. You know, you mentioned the performance, which I also was not particularly a fan of. I found him a little bit too flat and a little too unengaging. And this is going to sound horribly superficial, but I found him tough to look at. That kid's acne and like all
Ouch.
Of it. I only say that just because
I thought those were
too real.
Am I crazy? You know, I thought those were I guess I hoped those were scars from the crash.
No, that was like cystic acne.
That was.
I mean, they didn't do him any. They did not try to conceal it in any way, shape, or form.
This isn't me shitting necessarily on the aesthetic. It's more than anything. It felt so, he just felt like such a real 16-year-old kid to some degree, or 15, however old he is. Like, he's just so clearly grappling with identity and just a lack of understanding where he fits in the world. And he clearly has no compass from anybody, really, certainly within his family. And then on top of all of that, there's just the so knee deep in puberty, like just so written all over his face that it was just tough to.
I thought he was all right. I don't know.
I guess I don't know. I mean, I get what you guys are saying about him, and you're not wrong. I think my problem is that the Jesse is allowed so little agency. Like she has so little of a personality, and we don't really get a lot of insight into her and all the concern. Like, again, this goes back to my problem with how the movie is framed and who it's focusing on. It's not focusing on the actual rape victim. It's focusing on how her brother feels about it. And that is being used to justify him physically attacking and strangling her because he's upset. And he is upset. Like, I get that he's upset that she's lying to him and all of that. But like, what he is doing is also abusive. Everybody is abusing this poor girl in this movie, and nobody seems to be interested in her. Like, no, the movie is not interested on her perspective on it. It's not interested on her perspective of how she feels about her brother. She is just being objectified constantly in this movie over and over by everybody.
Including the director.
There's no question about that. There's no question about that. And I think it was one of the first things you said, Jessica, that, you know, kind of sticks with me is Tim Roth. Making a movie kind of about his experience, but not about his experience, using the point of view character that is his, you know, his access point potential. His access point is not the victim, but the person observing it. And the victim is a woman and not a man, like he was. So it's weird because he's like 95% of the way there to actually like kind of discussing something that is incredibly traumatic to him. But that extra 5% is really where, you know, we get lost and confused and troubling. And I think I don't know. Do you get bonus points for even going down this road that no one else goes down, or do you not? Do you get like is it one of those things where if you shoot this shot, you better not miss? Probably. Like, it's like, you know what I mean? Like, these are the worst movies ever made are the things that are about, you know, difficult subjects that do terrible jobs with it. Right.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, there's a lot of value in having an incest victim make a movie about incest. I think obviously their perspective is valuable, but I go back to the directorial responsibility. He clearly had not worked through his shit when he made this movie, and that made it not a good idea to make right now. Maybe he could make it now and it would have more perspective and he'd have more distance of it, that he wouldn't be exporting his trauma onto other people. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. He would be able to handle it all successfully, but
it's very sad.
Yeah,
it's a rough movie. I want to rate it because
I don't want to rate it.
Well, I don't want to rate it, but I don't want to talk about it.
I'm thinking about giving it an NA.
There is one really positive thing I want to say about it.
Yeah, please.
Which is that the thing I loved and the thing I think the movie nailed from the beginning was all of the phone conversations you hear his father having, where he seems like this genial, friendly businessman. It's not over the top. Like, he seems like a super nice guy, like a hardworking, good guy. And like, that does so much to underlie how nobody will believe these kids. Like, that was the depiction of the abuser was brilliant, I have to say.
Yeah, and I agree with both of you. I think that it is arguably maybe the only reason to make the movie to some degree or another. I think the idea, the fact that the movie tries to make a human being out of a monster, which many have tried, and it always feels like to some degree or another we're unsuccessful in doing so. This movie does do that quite well. It's interesting. You mentioned the phone calls. I don't know how you guys watch this. Did you watch it on Tubi or I rented it on Amazon?
I rented it on Amazon.
I watched it on Tubi.
Do you have the subtitles on by any chance?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
I did too.
The amount of inaudibles that are going on the subtitles were fucking hilarious.
Not on Tubi.
On Amazon.
On Tubi, they tried every one of them.
It was clear that whoever did the Amazon ones was like, this is some fucking weird UK English.
They're barely speaking English. Yeah.
I really do think this is, making a human being out of a monster, like, I'm all for. I know you guys are in agreement and you're saying the depiction of the rapist was exceptional. I think it was, not surprisingly, rape is a pretty big topic in movies in 1999, rape and murder and child rape and things like that. But we did a 2009 film called The Lovely Bones.
Oh God.
Which is one of the worst movies you'll ever see, in my opinion.
Have you seen it, Jessica?
I read the book. I didn't see the movie.
It's just an unbelievably bad film. And the, I can't believe that was a major studio movie.
I just can't look at Stanley Tucci that way. I can't allow that movie to destroy the Tucci for me.
It won't.
You know what you should watch? If you have a chance, go on YouTube, Jessica, and watch the Oscar clip. Because after they show the clip, Tucci, literally you can hear him say, "It's so horrible." Like, he literally says something along those lines that just makes you love him so much.
That's amazing.
It's mind blowing that was considered a good performance and that was considered a good
depiction. His only Oscar nomination.
And that was considered, this is how you do it. When you have a guy who's going to rape and murder a child, this is the way it's done. And that's really, the horrible messaging.
Oh, for sure. It's, we've seen so many movies try to depict this, in terms of the monster, the rapist, the murderer, the what have you. And it's so rarely successfully executed for so many reasons. I think that fundamentally, we were talking earlier about, art and what have you, but the second you project something onto something on a screen the size of a building, you are immediately turning it into something else, right? It's not a person anymore, right? And I commend this film. It's probably the only thing one of the only things I commend the film for, of really trying to dig into that idea of like what a person like this might actually be. Do you know what I'm saying? As opposed to
this is what this person actually is. And 99 times out of 100.
Yeah.
This is what this person actually is. Yeah. And I know it is, you certainly have your place for the Dylan Baker happiness portrayals and things like that. I think those are really interesting too. But I think filmmakers want to pretend like these people are more obviously devious than they are. I think they want to believe that you will be able to spot the monster in a crowd of people. And I don't believe that's ever the case.
Totally agree with you. Yeah.
So I think that's something that this movie really, really got across. So,
well, and it's also, I feel like, and I don't want to put words into directors' mouths because I don't know, but I look at, just to take Lovely Bones, for instance, right? I look at that performance. I look at the performance that Peter Jackson wanted out of him, the production, the costumes, all of it, right? And it's all from a filmmaker, surprisingly, who made Heavenly Creatures, which is, I would say, successful at attempting to do what it does. And I think it comes back to what you were saying, Kenny, of not really wanting to grapple with it, wanting to make it a little bit larger than life so it feels less scary to some degree or another and less real, right? Like, what makes this movie so harrowing is how scarily real it feels. You know what I mean? You feel like Ray Winstone is a real person. Like that, you know, of the three scenes that you were talking about, Kenny, of the first scene when he's just screaming up to the bedroom, that middle scene, the one where he's completely calm and he's lucid and he's just gaslighting the shit out of them, I actually found that the most scary of the three, right? Because that to me felt like I can see how this would be effective, and that's fucking scary.
I think what's really scary about this particular character,
yeah,
is that he is not a psychopath, he is not a sociopath, he is not even a particularly damaged person. This is just one aspect of his character. So to everyone else in the world, like, and it's, I think there's like this idea that someone who would do this is fundamentally broken in every way.
Yeah.
And what's really like they have, there's the moment where he, and Cheska, this is in the last part, but there's a moment where he's not allowed to see his baby. And he's, you know, clearly Tom's perspective is he shouldn't be around any of my siblings, right? Certainly not a woman, certainly not a girl, a young girl. And his thing is, you have to let me see my Alice, which is the kind of line you would never give to a rapist because you wouldn't want to humanize them in any way. But I think what filmmakers don't understand is the moment they rape, they no longer are viewed by the audience as someone worthy of empathy in any way. So at that point, everything else they do starts to become a, oh my God, like, this guy is doing this. This is horrible. This is terrifying. This could be anybody.
Yep.
So,
yep.
I know. So, I feel like they always have to fucking look like Stanley Tucci, like sneaking around looking for his next fucking victim. Not the real Tucci. Tucci in that movie. He should see his glasses and his outfit, glasses, the way he hair. Talks and the way he fucking stalks and the way he comes out from around corners. Like,
it's a cartoon character.
How the fuck did he last 50 years without getting arrested? Because he's so clearly on the lookout to do terrible things. All right.
I'm with you, Kenny, in terms of the fact that, like, it's kind of, this is an unrateable movie to some degree or another. I was ultimately just going to kind of, I mean, clearly I was not going to recommend people watch this film. At the same time, you know, we've been talking about it for a little over an hour now, and it has some compelling notions, some good performances. But yeah, I mean, I don't watch this movie. Like, I mean, I don't know what to say outside of that. I'm not, so rating it is sort of like, I don't know. It is what it is. I can't really rate it. But what I would like to talk about.
You can do it?
Okay.
I'll just do it.
All right, do it.
Because I did give it a rating before. I gave it a 45 before.
I mean, I gave it a 40, but yeah.
Which is like exactly where I think it should be. Like a 45. I do think that this has a lot to recommend. I also think life is too short. And I think there are other ways to, I think you should listen to this podcast.
Yeah. Just,
I think we, I think we did better. And I think we gave you, you know, the flavor of it, without having to, you know, eat the whole fucking souffle.
Jessica is going to now talk with us about her top 10 star 11, movies of 1999, because
and we're gonna judge her mercilessly.
We're not going to judge her mercilessly. So, you know, it's funny you say that, Kenny, because last night Jessica texted me and she's like, God, this list is so fucking basic, Kenny's gonna hate me. And I was like, Kenny's not gonna hate you. And the problem ultimately with this year, which
first of all, I love that.
I'm always thinking about you, Kenny.
Why do you think I would hate you? I'm just so curious.
It's a terrible list. It's an embarrassing list.
I guarantee
for reasons
you it's not.
I will get into.
All right.
I'm trying to think of what list I would hate. Because
Bride is not on it, but something possibly worse is.
Oh, wow.
Let's do it. Let's go. I'm excited now.
Start at the bottom, work your way up.
Okay. These are not in a particular order, but I will try Jessica, to order them.
What I would love to do is for you to pause after each one and let's talk a little bit about why it made your list. And
so do you have, just out of curiosity, Jessica, do you have a number one?
Yes.
Okay. So then whatever. The order up to that point is whatever. Okay. I'm just curious.
I will say these movies are all on here for one of three reasons. One, I genuinely think the movie is a great film. There's not that many of those. And honestly, I will admit, like, this is where I come clean as a dilettante. Like, there's a lot of really good movies from 99 I have not seen. So, like, Out of Sight is not on here because I haven't seen it.
Out of Sight's 98. Don't worry.
Okay, yeah, cool. Excellent.
But you should watch it. You'll love it.
Did you just write Anna and the King 11 times?
No, I do have Entrapment in the number two spot. all right. But okay. So either they're very good movies. They are movies that made us. Well, I guess there's only two reasons. They're movies that made a significant impact on me at the time. Like, because this was an interesting year for me. My family moved in the summer of 99, a block away from an independent movie house. So the second half of 99, I was 17. That was the first time I ever really went to movies on my own. And I started seeing independent films. And so and just seeing films every weekend, because I moved away kind of from all my friends. So like, some of these are movies that blew my mind because I didn't really know movies could do that. They're not necessarily good movies. And to prove that...
this is 11? Is this the 11 spot?
We'll get to 11. Because the thing about 11 is it's asterisk. It doesn't have a place.
Okay. So this is 10.
Okay. 10 is Varsity Blues.
I'm already loving this list.
And the reason why...
All right.
Let's roll. Blues opening night in a packed theater.
Yep.
And people were on their feet cheering at the football games. Like the whole audience. It was like a rock concert. It was unbelievable. And I'd never seen a movie have that effect. And, at the time I knew, like, this is not a very good movie. Like, it's not. But I think that movie is partially responsible for me never turning into a snob about movies. Cause it's like, I'm seeing this affect people on a visceral, emotional level, so much so that in a movie theater, they are compelled to get up and shout at the screen like they're at a football game. And that blew my mind.
That's cool.
So Varsity Blues is special to me for that reason.
Okay.
And then it gets murky. 10 Things I Hate About You is just on there because I think that movie gave us Heath Ledger in the way we came to understand him as charming, as a leading man, as, you know, this really kind of unusual energy. So I feel like, although it's a cute teen movie, like it, that gave a gift to cinema moving forward.
Okay.
So that's
all right. I'm okay with that too. This is, sure. This is fine so far.
We're in the bottom half of the list. It was just, for some reason, just most of the movies I saw that year were teen or romantic comedy related. So Notting Hill is on there.
Notting Hill's on my 10 list.
I hated that movie initially. I hated it for years. I found it really boring. And then the last like 10 years or so, it's become one of the rom-coms I just keep on rotation. Like, I think it's just got a maturity to it. And like a subtlety to the romance, like it never gets into really why they like each other. It's all, you just feel it. It's lovely.
It's the best.
It's the best.
It feels like an actual romance and not some fucking, you know, Taming of the Shrew situation or some fucking, you know, I guess that's what Taming of the Shrew is, but some duplicitous thing that got people into some romance under false pretenses. That's not what Notting Hill is. Notting Hill is about two people who just fucking fall for each other. They're different stations in life. Different stations in life. It's never going to work, but it could work. Love conquers all. It's the best fucking, it's the best rom, and it's also really funny. It's the best rom-com I think ever made. So that's, you know, that's my bias.
I agree. It's just lovely. I love all the side characters. They all have beautiful little grace notes. Absolutely. It's just an elegant film.
Yep.
And then we have Cruel Intentions.
All right. Now we're getting somewhere.
Cruel Intentions. I mean, what can you say? Like, again, I was 17. It was sleazy. It was sexy. I didn't understand that movies could be like philosophically complex and geared toward teenagers.
Uh-huh.
It had an amazing soundtrack. This is one of the ones I'm saying, like, this is just fucking basic. I just love this movie.
No, I crazy about that movie. And it, you know, the what came out of this podcast, this long running podcast thing, is I know it's not going to make my top 10 list at the end of the year, but I also know that, like, as much as any movie, that's the kind of movie I wish got made every fucking week. It's perfect. It's so awesome. What I love about it, now that I'm thinking about it, is it was made cheaply, yet it feels so fucking maximalist.
Yep.
And I'm crazy about that. Like, it feels so big only because these emotions and these machinations are just so much bigger than even these characters can pull off. I mean, the actors can pull off. And I think the actors, like, come close enough. Like, I love, like, I mean, I think Sarah Michelle Gellar is amazing in this movie. And I love her, like, grown-ups, you know, like, her grown-up cosplay. I love her, like, yeah, you know, 40-year-old femme fatale, you know, Upper East Side, like, monster cosplay thing. She's the best in this film. You know, great choice.
Funny. Have you guys watched Do Revenge?
No, not yet.
Is it good?
You know, I liked it. I didn't dislike it, but Sarah Michelle Gellar plays a headmaster in the film.
Yeah, she says it's like Catherine grown up, right?
Yeah. I mean, the movie does feel like it's trying to be Cruel Intentions meets Clueless, which is a tone that's tough to thread. But seeing Sarah Michelle Gellar again, you're just like, she was great. You know, and she should just work more. I'd just love to see her in more things. But anyway,
in terms of cultural significance, I feel like that's another movie that birthed forward Gossip Girl and the entire era of shows.
100%.
Okay, so there's one more on the bottom five, and that's But I'm a Cheerleader, which was another one that was just like,
we love that movie.
I didn't know movies could do that. I didn't know we were allowed to talk about that. I was a, you know, baby bisexual at the time, and so that one was a little personal revelation for me, and I loved it. All right, here's where I'll talk about the asterisk. I hate having this movie on my list, and I feel bad about it.
Oh boy,
I know.
And I mean, I should, like, this I'm is sure. the thing. I know, this course. Is the movie that has fallen the farthest in reputation since there's it came one, out. Which is answer.
Can't hear you, Kenny.
There's only one answer.
Yeah. What do you think?
It's American Beauty.
It's American Beauty. Yeah. Yes. The script is so fucking gorgeous. And honestly, I know, like, Kevin Spacey is a pedophile. Nobody should ever watch this movie again. But I do think that the actual story it's trying to tell about him and the young teenage girl feeds into the plot's idea of you don't actually want the things you're being told to want. Your society is telling you that old men should want young, hot women. And when you get down to it and realize that this is a kid and it's a virgin, you're going to realize, like, you don't fucking want that. And that's what the whole movie is over and over again, is you don't want the beautiful house. You don't actually want this. Like, you don't need to keep up this facade that you're not gay, and how destructive that those following those impulses against your own actual desires can be. Like, that's how I see that movie.
That's a nice read.
Yeah,
it isn't. That's a generous read.
I know. And I think the score is beautiful. I think Annette Bening is amazing. Like,
he is.
It's funny.
The score is beautiful. Annette Bening is amazing.
The score, I agree with we those. Talked about that on our Red Violin episode. You know, it's funny you bring it up, because I actually just, apropos of nothing, I watched the pilot of 6 Feet Under today. And, you know, I...
As he does every Thursday.
As I do every Thursday. and I
Wednesday is West Wing Day.
I do think that it's a purer version of Alan Ball's sort of... perspective on the world. I think that American Beauty, and I'm sure you've read all the stuff about American Beauty's sort of production and how the script changed pretty drastically over the process. Yeah. So it does feel a little bit like, and I think I like the script, parts of the script I really love. I would not have given it best original screenplay in 1999 personally. There are other films that I think deserved it more, being John Malkovich probably being at the top of that list. But I do think that, to your point, and I mentioned this when we did our episode on American Beauty many, many moons ago, it was supposed to be our first movie, and then we decided to move it for obvious reasons.
Well, I mean, the Kevin Spacey accusations came out between us recording it and launching the podcast.
Oh, wow.
Correct.
So,
we're going to change this. But I do want to say that what I do love about it is what you can see in 6 Feet Under, which is the grappling of the existential sort of idea of, is there something after this? The magic realism that exists within the two pieces are the thing that I love the most. But yeah, it deserves a pretty giant asterisk next time.
I think it stinks, but you know, what are you going to do?
And the thing was, this was another one that I saw it, I think, in the theaters and hated, thought it was the worst movie I'd ever seen. And then like 3 years later, rented it and saw it again for some reason, just out of lack of options, and was like, oh, holy shit, I missed everything that was interesting about this movie. But yeah, huge, huge asterisk, not technically on the list.
When we wrap up this podcast in, which is crazy to say, in a few weeks,
a couple months,
but I do feel like we have to kind of grapple with, like, we need to do not just like our favorites. Like, there's other lists we have to do, I feel like, to some degree, of like, you know, most overrated or aged the best, and that
kind I'll come like, you know, we do those. Yeah, we'll do tens for a lot of those. All right,
okay. Sorry, Jessica.
That's all right. All right, number five is a gimme. It's Toy Story 2.
Yes.
Perfect movie. There's really nothing to say about it. It has the deeply traumatic Sarah McLachlan song hook, which I will never forgive people.
During Jesse's abandonment, you're broken.
Is it your favorite Toy Story? It sounds like it is.
It's my favorite Toy Story. It's not my favorite.
Your favorite Pixar?
I go back and forth a lot. I can usually not pick. I would say gut instinct is Finding Nemo is my favorite.
Okay.
So that one is easy. This is where I become an absolute, I hate myself for the rest of this list. All right. Number four, we're going to say is Fight Club.
Yep.
No, I'm with you. I'm saying the exact opposite thing, which is, I hope that the Fight Club thing starts going up again, because it's so much better than its current reputation.
Yeah.
Its current reputation has, like, I get it. It's been, you know, it's been co-opted by, I guess, the incel community or something to that extent, but not really A, and B, like, whatever, you know, like it means nothing. Like so is The Matrix, right? It really ultimately means nothing. The film was brilliant. The film, like, so brilliant. It's one of our favorite episodes, but
yeah,
I mean, was very afraid to watch that movie and do this movie because, one, I never really loved it. And two, I didn't want to come out against it. And I was so happy, but I was so happy because coming out against it's very boring to me in this day and age. But I'm so, so satisfied with that film. So great.
Well, I'm also, you know, you mentioned it. It's worth just underlining it for a quick second that, you know, we talked about, how do we do this movie? Who do we do this movie with? And Karin Kusama, who couldn't have been a better guest for us, just in terms of, she really, like, it was truly the perfect guest to have on, just in terms of, obviously, a director, a female director, the way that she, like, she rewatched it, obviously, to do the pod, and the way that she saw it through the prism of today, really buoyed the movie for me. I don't know if you felt the same way, Kenny, but, like, just...
Oh, definitely.
It allowed me to sort of... It's so interesting, too, because, like, you look at Fincher's filmography, and it's... It's the one that people kind of go like, yeah, but that's like the bro-y men's rights movie that he did. And it's like, no, there's nothing about Fincher's filmography that would lead you to believe that that was his take on this movie. And it's unfortunate that it's been tagged with that a little bit.
You know, a couple of people I respect take the POV that, you know, essentially, not necessarily that depiction is endorsement, but that by depicting something, you're putting by depicting something and depicting something in the way that Fincher does with fighting in this, or Scorsese he does with the mob in his movies, you are glamorizing it, and that sensory memory is going to override any underlying message that is really kind of the mission statement of the movie. I strongly disagree with that. I don't think you make movies for the dummies. It is unfortunate that dummies sometimes co-opt these films or try to steal these movies. I mean, The Matrix is another one. But what are you going to do? What do you do? Not make movies? Do your best.
What's your three, Jessica?
My three is Galaxy Quest.
Oh, wow. You got a great list.
Good movie. And it feels great so... Movie.
No, you got a great list.
Co-opt a term. It feels very soft boy. Like, I feel like this list makes me not feel like a serious film person. But I'm really not. I have weird... random taste as the rest of this list.
No, I like this list.
All right. Galaxy Quest, just perfect. There's, again, nothing to say. The best version of that kind of movie you could ever make. Mm-hmm. And Alan Rickman.
Yeah. So that's just for those keeping count, that's two Tim Allens. Go ahead.
It is two.
Well, here we go. Staying on the Alan Rickman theme, my number two movie is Dogma.
Wow.
Which I think, as someone who is the daughter of a Catholic deacon, is the most profound movie about Catholicism that has ever been made. And yes, Scorsese can take a damn seat. I think this is the most interesting.
This is the hottest take you've ever had.
I know. This is the most interesting movie. And my father agrees with me. My father, who is a deacon, agrees with me. Like, this movie tackles the concept of grappling with what the church has come to be versus what its origins were supposed to be about in a more honest and authentic way than any movie has ever touched. And I mean, the man got death threats over it. So he was jumping up and down on the right notes to scare the institutionalists of Catholicism. I think it was a daring movie. I wish to God he had kept making movies like this.
We still have one more to go.
Just one.
I do just want to say we don't need to do a whole relitigation.
No, Dogma.
I'll just say this because I actually liked it. I think I liked it a little bit more than Kenny. And our guest was Sean O'Connor, who is a big View Askew or grew up a big View Askew fan. I think it's been tempered in the years since, but I actually didn't hate it. I think it's a more accomplished movie than it's given sort of credence to having. Just on a purely production level, I think it's the best movie he's physically made.
Sure.
Shit Monster aside, I do think that it's, you can tell.
Shit Monster aside.
You can tell he's legitimately really trying. And I think he stops trying basically after that movie.
Yeah.
But it's a bold, crazy film, and it's kind of amazing that it was attacked as much as it was by the Catholic right. Because it's a silly movie that's kind of, for all intents and purposes, saying like Catholicism is kind of silly, and like this is kind of it's a little ridiculous that we. That we put as much stock in it as we do, or in religion across the board.
I don't know. It's not for me.
It's not Kenny's tempo.
I think I said this on the pod when I was 17 in 99. When I was 17, I had a top 10 list of all the movies ever made, and Dogma was on the list. Mm-hmm. So there certainly was a moment in my life when I thought this was transcendent, a transcendent piece of filmmaking, but I don't anymore.
I don't know. I mean, like, I just have to defend it. Like, he knew his audience. He knew his audience better than a lot of filmmakers did at the time. He knew who he was talking to, and he decided to make this extremely authentic story about his own struggle with the religion he'd been raised in and try to share it with that audience. He didn't try to speak to an audience that was not this. He wasn't suddenly trying to be a legit mainstream. Yeah. He was trying to talk about himself honestly and authentically. And I think that was so brave. And I think then he got scared and he stopped trying to do that. I think he was so impressed by it.
I think he was too. I think personally, I think people who are into Kevin Smith are also the kind of people who think religion is a joke. So I am also that kind of person. So I'm certainly, you know, I that's in no way, you know, condemning anybody, but I think that he was preaching to the choir personally. And I think any death threats, any blowback from the Catholic Church he got was exactly what he wanted. So
I don't know. He's talked about it and he was profoundly affected by it. He didn't think anybody would see it. I do get the sense that he's never really, he knows who he is.
He didn't think people would see the Affleck Damon, Alanis Morissette, Chris Rock movie. I mean, come on, Kev.
Maybe I don't know that he saw, I don't know that he thought it would have, that it would be as explosive as it was.
Yeah. I think that really freaked him out. I mean, I think that's why you've seen the kind of latter movies you've seen out of him.
I wish we had you on for the Dogma Pod.
Yeah.
We had no idea.
I had no idea, or I genuinely, I mean.
All right.
All right. What's your number one?
Before you say it, there are a lot of really good movies that are not on your list. And I don't mean that as a judgment. I mean to say, I have no idea what's going to be number one.
Yeah,
I would like you to guess. I want you both to guess.
I guess Election.
I'm going to guess The Matrix.
You are both. I hate both of those movies.
Whoa.
Hate. Election, I will admittedly, I haven't seen again since 99. So I didn't like it at the time and I haven't rewatched it. But The Matrix.
You're a wild card.
I know.
Can I just say?
No.
Wait. All right. So let's have more guesses.
Yeah, I'm gonna guess again.
All right.
Oh wow.
This feels, I'm gonna say Talented to Mr. Ripley. No?
Huh. Okay. I'm still a guy. It's a good guess. I'm going to say, geez Louise, Sixth Sense.
No, although I like both of those, but no, neither one is on my list.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
The Insider.
Great film.
Great movie.
Yeah. Never in a million years
would
have guessed
that on this list.
Such a great movie, though.
This list was amazing. This list is everything I could have wanted it to be. It was all left turn.
Varsity Blues to The Insider.
The thing about The Insider, which is like, it's like, I can't even get over that, like, I don't know how to explain this, what just happened with your list, because like you're, it's like you just flew us. It's like you flew us through a fucking asteroid field and somehow landed like right on the
just like,
right. But yeah. Like, just like the middle fucking landing pad. And
it was incredible.
The middle landing strip.
Like movies for a lot of different reasons. You know, I was raised in this weird
Insider.
Way where my dad would just bring home whatever he thought looked interesting from the video store. So like, I feel like I never developed a dedication to the canon. And sure. Also like, but I saw enough of the canon great films that I appreciate them. So yeah, my taste is insane. And this is why I have trouble selling screenplays.
Because
people are
amazing to me.
You know my hot insider take, right?
No.
My hot insider take is Pacino is the performance of that movie.
Oh,
that's
absolutely.
Mine.
I agree with you.
No, yeah. Okay. So we're in agreement.
Not that hot of a take.
It's a hot take. I don't know. Phil doesn't agree, but I felt like I was the only one. I know you love them both, but it's always like, you know, Crow is nominated. Everyone thinks it's Crow's movie. To me, like, the story is the Pacino story. That's like, that's the story of the film and his, you know, his kind of internal grappling with how to handle this guy and how important the story is that he's telling. Is it something he should be doing or something he shouldn't be doing? Or is it worth this man's life in the balance? I love his performance in this film so much. Great film.
Well, what I was going to say is not that I disagree. I just don't know that it's as binary as that. Like, I really don't think that Russell Crowe's performance is Russell Crowe's performance without Al Pacino and vice versa. You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to put a gun to my head and say, which is the showier performance, it's obviously Russell Crowe. It's the one that obviously got all the acclaim. It's the one that, you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, put him on the map. And we all kind of agree probably should have won that year.
No, not having seen every movie of the year, but out of the nominees, maybe.
Out of the nominees.
Maybe out of the nominees, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, although Farnsworth is spectacular in Straight Story.
I would say like Pacino should have been nominated twice and should have split it with himself.
That being said, I do think that it's
not just for for this in any given Sunday. He should have nominated his wife. And he should have split the vote with himself when no one else should have gotten any vote, and he should have had to go up there twice.
And his Oscar clip should have been the speech about inches.
I'm so, you know, I hate the repurposing of that speech. I hate the repurposing, but you know, I'm like, I
have
don't
you seen any given Sunday? Justin?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't understand. It infuriates me. It's like, it's, you know what it is? It's like playing fucking Born in the USA at a Reagan rally. Like, you, how can you have this like speech? How could you have a speech about like how important this game is and how important everything is in a movie that's explicitly about how horrible this game is?
Well, you know what's funny, to which is exactly what you're talking about, is the idea that the terminology snowflake comes from Fight Club, which is actually making fun of toxic masculinity and all of these idiots, but it's been co-opted by the right to make fun of libs. Like, it's, you gotta fucking twist yourself into pretzels.
I've taken it back. We're not the snowflakes. We can live in cities.
But you understand my point. Like, it's just the co-opting of things, or just the blatant disregard for the clear intent of it, is just infuriating.
Sure. But I mean, hey, literally the reason Twitter was worthwhile was Elon Musk saying, take the red pill, Ivanka Trump saying, take in, and Lily Wachowski saying, fuck both of you. Or might have been Lana. I don't know. One of the Wachowskis.
One of the people. Like, it's
fuck both of you. I think it's fuck you both, but it's so good. It's
perfect.
Ivanka Trump saying taken. I mean,
Jessica,
right.
This list
good
was
list, Jessica.
Perfect.
Good this list. I can't wait to do this with more guests, Phil.
Yeah, it's going to be great. It is.
Thank you for being our guinea pig.
Of course.
Going from Varsity Blues to The Insider in 10 moves is something. Also, can I just say, hating Election and The Matrix is also a hot take, Jessica.
I really probably do have to watch Election again, because I may have been too stupid to understand it, but I hated it at 17.
You'd love it.
You might like it.
I'm not a fan of cynical movies in general, which was the vibe that very much gave off to me. That is the anti me kind of movie.
I hate Alexander Payne with every fiber of my being, and I think Election is one of the greats.
I'll give that another shot. I'm not budging on The Matrix.
Whatever, that's fine. But whatever it is with whatever he does with Election, makes me almost think it was an accident. I mean, I think I watched that movie and I said, no, everything is so finely tuned that it couldn't possibly be an accident. So I don't know what the fuck happened, but something happened. Like,
I think it's worth noting too,
his cynicism took over.
And his misogyny.
He's the most misogynistic human who's ever been allowed to make a movie. And he's made 8 of them or whatever, but Election is not that. It only is that if you plot it as the first point on a line that goes to Kristen Wiig doing the worst thing that anyone's ever done in a movie and downsizing.
I think what's interesting about the film, if we're going to just talk for a brief second about Alexander Payne, it's one of the few films, well, no, I guess he has adapted a fair amount of things. The source material of Tom Perrotto's novel gives him the blueprint to make that film, obviously. And I think there's a bunch of ways, obviously, to skin a cat when it comes to adaptation, but I do think that, and then just reading the Tracy Flick sequel that came out earlier this year, I do think that Tom Perrotta creates in the Tracy Flick character something that's so sort of unimpeachable and kind of, I don't want to say bulletproof, but that it would have been tough for Payne to fuck it up, for what that's worth. Very curious to see if he directs the sequel. I'm of the mind that maybe he should not, but who knows?
All right,
it'd be interesting. Jessica, a blast as always. This was harrowing and then a lot of fun. You know, we ended.
I'm glad I could bring us out of incest back into
The Insider and Varsity Blues and. But no, truly, I mean, I thank you so much for coming on to talk about this rough movie. You know, obviously subject matter triggering and all that sort of stuff. This was a great episode. I think we did justice to a very difficult movie. And it's primarily thanks to you. So truly. Oh,
thank you guys so much. And congratulations on being close to wrapping it up. You both have done such an amazing job with this podcast.
Thank you so much.
There's no question that my guess is you'll be back.
You think? You think I'll make it back in?
I think you're going to be back. I feel like there's still a bunch of ways to go
out. Do we need to redo the Dogma episodes?
Oh, man. Can you imagine relitigating Dogma?
Well, I don't know. I don't want to watch it again. That's for sure.
No, I don't really want to watch it again either. But okay.
All right. Jessica, great. Thank you so much. Yeah, great to see you, Jessica.
Thanks,
guys. Take care.
Talk to you later. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.